Godalming. Godalming, hello. Welcome. Welcome back, indeed. The last time we met, it was raining. Glad that's changed. Welcome to Pulp Diction 3. That's a whole third of Jim Bowen's act, right there. I don't do the other two, the three. Pulp Diction 3, like some kind of sloth rapper. That's what that is tonight. The storytelling evening where there are no rules and the names are drawn from a hat, or from the hat band of Godfrey, our resident mascot for the Godalming Theatre Festival, such as it is, because yes, welcome to Godalming, yourselves, to your own theatre festival. Who knew? Here in Café Mila, in the warm embrace of Steve and Jane, I hope you've shown them your hospitality as they've shown us theirs, here in the heart of downtown Godalming. Or Angel Court, more sort of the spleen, really, sort of maybe kind of next to the heart, that kind of thing. The Godalming Theatre Festival presents to you this evening, what is that, a many-headed hydra, that is not so much a theatre festival, more a way of life, if you enjoy the theatre. It all started with a campaign to try and buy a building to have permanent professional theatrical productions in the heart of Godalming, and that remains the essence of what we're trying to do. We also would like to host an actual festival next year, but in order to host an actual festival, we need you, the community, because it's a community activity, it's not a service. So ask not what the Godalming Theatre Festival can do for you, but just remember, there's nothing to fear but fear itself. Something like that. Anyway, without further ado, because that would be ado, I give you our first act this evening. And I would like to ask Jack Lynch, maybe you draw your own name, I don't know. But
should I just, I'll close me off.
Yeah. Good choice, sir, good choice. I do apologise. It's like one of those sort of videos when you're a kid, where it's like, now I'm going to direct it, and then I'm going to be in it, and then we're all going to watch it, I'm going to make you, I'm going to cook the food and everything. But I will be doing the first act. Bob Cryer would like to play, I can't even read my own writing, would like to plug the Godalming Theatre Festival. But he can't think of a creative event that would sum up its aims. Heart, what Bob has to say about Heart. Bob met his wife in Godalming, which is strange, because he thought she was at home with the kids. So, well, you've got time. All right, so this is, there's no, for those of you here to see Priyanka Burford, she sends her apologies. She's unable to join us this evening, but we have a crack team of writer-performers, or a team of writer-performers on crack to entertain you this evening. I can have a drink after this, so. This is called Heart versus Head. Excuse me, I'm just going to grab some water. My dearest Holmes, I am very much in your debt for the good grace that you showed last evening when I announced to you that I was to leave early this morning in order to attend to matters of the heart, matters that have now grown beyond my control. I admit, things have taken a turn, which I could not have anticipated. In some ways they have, within the last 48 hours, become much clearer. In some ways, they have become much more complicated. I'm sure you can appreciate, dear friend, the position this puts me in vis-a-vis our flat share would probably be the wrong word, but whatever it is that we've built up over the last 2 years, it's definitely a thing. I want you to know that regardless of the circumstances consequentially created by my actions, I remain your fond, deep and loving, your really, really, really good friend, John Henry Watson. P.S. I feel churlish to mention this, especially on the occasion of such a fresh parting. But this morning, in my attempts to light the fire in our study so that I might attain sufficient heat to write this letter to you, I couldn't help but notice that you have now found yourself in the custom of keeping your Indian cigars in the coal scuttle. I'm not complaining, but as far as I'm aware, the flavour and aroma of the Trichinopoly leaf is by no means enhanced by its proximity to residual carbon derivatives. As I'm soon to spend a little more time away from your company, initially I thought it might be meet to avoid mentioning the fact. However, there is an urgency within me that I can only attribute to the fact that I have some concern as to your well-being and the state of your mind, given the circumstances of our separation. I'm hardly one to lecture you on the vice of the humidor, but that cough of yours isn't going away anytime soon. After all, you've always told me that a well-aired cigar is a beautiful thing. At least I think that was the gist of what you said. Quite an image, Holmes. Thank you for that. But really, scuttles are for coal. You know that. Okay, all right, here's the rub. Those cigars were a gift. And, well, I expected you to treat them as such. Perhaps you could have stored them in a Moorish ebony cigar box that I gave you last Easter. Also a gift. It sits on top of your bureau, in case you were wondering, under a pile of papers. As a consulting detective, I rather assumed you might have spotted the clue as being in its name. It's not called a cigar box for flippancy. Just a thought. Very, very much sincerely yours, and eternally your good friend, J.H.W. P.P.S. Now I think about it, it occurs to me that you may have put the Indians in the coal scuttle because you didn't like them. And I just want to say, that's okay. But why didn't you say so at the time? No, stop it, Watson. You're talking nonsense. There are copious amounts of white ash around the fire, so he must be smoking them. And perhaps I shouldn't have written that last bit, but it's fine. Fine, really, really. I'm sorry. Carry on. Forget I even mentioned it. See you soon. I've left some biscuits in the cupboard. Just don't eat them all at once. Sorry, no, not that I'm saying you're fat or anything. It's just, you know, look after yourself. My dear Watson, having taken my pen in hand, I must admit that I too recall a favourite saying of yours. Written matter must be presented in such a way as may be of interest to the reader. Whether the passing years or your current passing fancy have led you to forget your own maxim, such as one may call it a maxim, I know not. But I thought it best to remind you that, given that you are a doctor, a long career of written apology awaits you. However, I do thank you for your letter nonetheless, which I enclose for your own records. You'll notice that not only have I applied several spelling corrections and annotated the margins, but I've also included the Gentleman's Pocket Guide to English Grammar as something of an aide memoir. I trust that you will keep it about your person regularly, perhaps when you're out shopping for gifts. Incidentally, I should disclose that I discovered your letter some distance from its initial resting place. The immediate square foot of carpet that begins 4 inches from my door displays multiple nap interruptions consistent with a succession of retractions that I conclude were either motivated by your indecision or that the letter got mixed up with some of Mrs. Hudson's rather less obtrusively dropped eaves in the middle of the corridor. The lightly smoked scorch mark of her beeswax candle and the rather more obvious streak of lard on the reverse caused by the incision of her kitchen cleaver suggested the latter. However, by closer inspection of the envelope, I can confidently conclude that the former may not be entirely dismissed. The inverse brush marks I found on the carpet betray an action perpetrated by a weight more consistent with that of a heavy vellum fibre, rather than that of the standard army issue paper you traditionally use, and I perhaps ended up using here. One recalls that almost immediately that a lavender-scented vellum notelet was Miss Mary Morstan's weapon of choice when she secured our services but a year ago. So perhaps my abiding memory of you, John, will be that you have left a hint of lavender in my corridor. Perhaps not. The adventure of the vellum absence, as you may rather prosaically put it, begins with you switching envelopes at the last minute. The only envelope you can retrieve silently without waking me is the one housing some piece of romantic ephemera in your inside pocket. You make the switch for fear of representing yourself as a kept man. Perhaps Mrs. Hudson, having herself read the contents, as is her wont. And if you are reading this, Mrs. Hudson, I would be grateful if you could stop eating our biscuits and then switch the envelopes on your behalf. Also, for fear of you being represented to me as a kept man. So, the result of either, if correct, still makes you look like a kept man. Perhaps now doubly so. Just don't forget who kept you first. After all, once you have eliminated the impossible, whatever remains, however improbable, must be the truth. Given that I have eliminated a virus of silent flying monkeys that feast only on vellum paper, infiltrating our quarters at midnight, and also, perhaps more pertinently, Mrs. Hudson has run out of lard, then I can only retrieve one answer. Oh God, you're sleeping with her, aren't you? Maybe you think that excuses the inconsistencies of your letter. I fear that you, a man who's not only achieved the rank of second lieutenant, but has also attained the post of army surgeon, may have failed to spot the most dreadful mistake of all, one that I find so hard to fathom. It is as follows. To the untrained eye, wood ash and tobacco ash are immediately decipherable. So, dear man, you are already out of breath at the start of the race. However, to the trained eye, and yes, I'm obviously talking about myself here, there is as much difference between the black ash of an Indian Trichinopoly cigar and the white ash of a Panatella picole as there is between a cabbage and a potato. I've never spoke to an Indian in my life. I thought you knew that. Good luck with what's her face. Sincerely, S.H. My dear Holmes, are you high? Again. Calm down, all right? They were a gift. I thought that you might like to try something new. Well, obviously not. Evidently, I hadn't remembered your monograph on the ashes of 140 different varieties of pipe, cigar, and cigarette. My apologies. How could one forget those several hours during the sleepless nights of last summer that I had dedicated to the understanding of it? I won't get those hours back again, no matter how many times I walk home backwards. And what is a monograph, anyway? Do I have to spell it out to you? No matter how badly you think I might spell it out to you? I am getting married to Mary Morstan. Deal with it. I have to say, I'm not impressed with who you've become. There are perhaps some varied little matters in which your personal habits over the past 18 months have marked you out as one of the most truly untidy men that have ever driven a fellow lodger to distraction. When I find a man who keeps his tobacco in the toe end of a chewed up Persian slipper, his pants in the cutlery drawer, and his unanswered correspondence transfixed by a jackknife to the centre of our carved wooden mantelpiece, then I begin to give myself virtuous airs. Who brought you up? Fagin? I've always held, too, that pistol practice should be distinctly an open-air pastime. I won't miss those interminable long days when you get into one of your moodies. When I would return to find you hunched over in your armchair, primed with a hair trigger and 100 Boxer cartridges, then furiously firing bullets off in all directions. I don't mind saying that I felt strongly that neither the atmosphere nor the appearance of our room was greatly improved by that kind of behaviour. Our chambers, too, are perpetually full of chemicals and criminal relics, which would turn up in the sink or in the butter dish, or in even less desirable places. It's no picnic waking up to find the mummified hands of the Lambeth fiddler cupping your nethers. You are the very worst tenant in London, Dr. W. P.S. The invitation is enclosed. Don't be late. I've left more biscuits. Mr. H and the good doctor. I've been reading your exchanges, as indeed I do any that I can get my hands on, with great interest. And I've only one thing to say. Get a room. Oh, hold on. Silly me. You already have a room. A room that you haven't paid for. I'll be awaiting the £3 you owe me downstairs in the kitchen with a stiff gin and that bloody pistol of yours pointed at your wallet. Oh, and you can't have it back until I've been paid. I assume that you can pay, given the amount of comings and goings that have been here recently, but now that there is just one of you, perhaps a little less chin-stroking, Mr. H, and a little more elbow grease. You won't find a doctor's salary at the end of a syringe. You also won't find a better friend. So if you want to deduce anything, I'd start by concluding that logical reason and friendship won't balance my books. Look at your brother. You want to end up like him? Mrs. H. P.S. We are out of lard. So you could either of you pick up some on your way back from the kindergarten. My dear Watts, evidently our game is no longer afoot, and it has ended, as many of our early games did, in the kitchen. You have not, I hoped, learned to despise my pipe and my lamentable tobacco so much as to refuse to join me in a celebratory trichinopoly this weekend. I'm afraid, though, it has rather taken the place of food these days. Now that I'm on a case, the state of my health is not a matter in which I take the faintest interest. My mental detachment is absolute. Wide. The faculties become refined when you starve them. Surely, as a doctor, my dear Watson, you must admit that your digestion gains in the way of blood supply, so much is lost to the brain. Detection is, or ought to be, an exact science, and should be treated in the same cold and unemotional manner. You have always attempted to tinge it with romanticism, which produces much the same effect as if you worked a love story or an elopement into the frith proposition of Euclid. I am, and always have been, a brain, Watson. The rest of me is a mere appendix. Therefore it is the brain I must use to solve this case. Only you are not a case. Therefore reason demands that it is the brain that begs your forgiveness. An occasional weekend visit would be most welcome. Pray give my greetings to the current Mrs. Watson, and believe me to be, my dear fellow, very sincerely yours, Sherlock Holmes. P.S. Come at once, if convenient. If inconvenient, come all the same. Let me see you once more in the customary armchair, and if you will not begrudge me my head, I will not begrudge you your heart.
Thank you.
So, that is part one of Pulp Diction 3 for the second time, or third time, depending on who. So, Margaret, with your eyes closed, I'd like you to pick...
I'm not going
to
get the hat.
Pick the hat. Who is it? Edie?
Yes.
Do you want to read this? Edie Campbell from Lynchpin Productions, ladies and gentlemen, all the way from Fun School, Bin School, and all pots, and all points in between.
This says, Jack Lynch hails from Iowa, is artistic director of Lynchpin Productions, teaches part-time at PPA, is an independent celebrant, as well as a father and a grandfather, and occasionally writes a few lines.
And I didn't write on the other side about heart because, well, you'll get it when you hear this.
Ladies and gentlemen, Jack Lynch. Thank you.
So, when Bob told me that the theme for tonight was heart, Bob has done some readings for us. We have a thing that we call script teams, where we do rehearsed readings of plays once a month. So we tease out the scripts. The next one is on the 25th of March, with two new scripts, two one-acts, by local writers. So we try to do old scripts, new scripts, and everything in between. So Bob has read for us a couple of times, and it's been great. So he said the theme was heart. And I immediately thought of a couple of poems that I wrote regarding, I wrote them on the day that my grandson was born, a year ago on January 17th. So this was the first one. This kind of came right away when I found out he was with us in Iowa. He was born in the same hospital I was born in. Be... Have yourself. Here it is, we won. It doesn't get any better than this constant, constant. I only know you from being told you are here. I have yet to meet you in the flesh. You are now in a state of grace, and those around you are falling in love with your serene innocence. Welcome, dear one. Be, have yourself. You have been expected. And if we are paying attention, we shall learn so very much from you because of who you are and what you bring. Already you have changed me. Already I know more because of who you are. Rest upon your mother's bosom. It is enough for now. The two of you have traveled a difficult though glorious road today, and you both deserve a good rest. Rest and be and have. Your larger journey will begin soon enough. Any other grandparents out here? Yeah? A grandchild changes you. It's quite an amazing experience. This one came later in the day. At about 5 o'clock in the evening, I was standing out on my back stoop in Dinskum. And I was feeling both the presence of my grandson and the fragility of life. Because also there was a lot of news happening in the States, still going on. It happened the month before, some of you may be aware, as the ongoing shootings that happened in the States. And the Sandy Hook Elementary School, where 20 plus children, 6-year-olds were slaughtered, and 6 staff. And so I was feeling that. And there was part of me that said, I want to bring my little family over here, where presumably it's a bit safer. So I was feeling this. Joy for the world. It smells of Christmas outside, though it is January 17th. And our own little Jesus bundle appeared today, bringing joy to this world, of ionized snowy air, filled, sadly, with cries from victims of the never-ending Herod slaughter of innocence. Flee to the Egypt of our love, dear one, and nestle into the sands of our ingrained devotion to you. We cannot help ourselves but to love you, and for that we are glad. We are grateful. That is your gift to us, to fall in love yet again. And that is joy for the world. Thank you for that. Yes. Thank you for that not small gift. But we cannot promise you safety. We cannot promise you life. There are no promises, no matter what any snake oil seller offers. Promises dissipate faster than my breath crystals in this frosty air, except the promise that nothing stays the same. There is only our journey toward crucifixion to hang out, to dry what is not useful, and surrender to that. And that, dear one, it's probably not something one wants to hear on one's birthday, I suppose. But there is one promise I hope to keep, to always give you the truth, wrapped in love and ribboned with compassion, like a gift found disguised under your Christmas tree. So, and then with Heart, I decided to read this. This is, I wrote for Edie last Valentine's Day. I wrote this in her card. So this is a bit, this will sound like somebody from Iowa. And with a little bit of sort of E.E. Cummings influence towards the end. You know what? This is what it is like to stay the course. All that through thick and thin shit feels like this. All that death till death do us part crap has taken us this far. And I'm sure we ain't seen the worst storm love has to offer us, but hell. What do you say? Might as well keep on keeping on because, as we both have said many times before, if not with you, then who? If not now, when? Continue to be my with and when, again and again.
That's Jack Lynch, ladies and gentlemen. Thank you very much. Scripts tease on the
25th
at the Star Inn in Guildford, Guildford High Street. Jack Lynch, Lynchpin Productions.
Lynchpin Productions.
.co.uk.
Yes. Yeah. No, Lynchpin. Lynchpin. PTC.
See you on the 25th. Okay. So. To the ultimate of the first half of Pulp Fiction 3, Godfrey's hat. If you haven't met Godfrey yet, he is designed by Gina McAdam, who is an artist who operates about as central in town as you can get, the Wilfrid Noyce Centre. She does great children's parties, I know that for a start. And my 11-year-old daughter made some fascinators. So if you're looking for that kind of thing, look for her. But she also kindly gave us this. And Godfrey also has rather a large hole in his head to accept notes. Coins are at the back, but notes are here. And the checks. So he's serving a dual purpose. So, Ossian, would you... Yeah, I'm going to shield your eyes so you can take your pick. Are you the first person to choose yourself?
Not at all.
Who do we have?
It's my friend Margaret K. Vaughan Smith.
Fantastic. Ladies and gentlemen, Margaret K. Vaughan Smith. Yeah. Any stage management for this? You're all right.
No. All right. In fact, I'm going to keep this here, even though you all know there's nothing on it. It's sort of security.
Do you want me to read out this thing?
Ossian. Would like to read your plug.
Comedy writer, performer, follow me on Twitter at McCaborn Smith.
I can't spell that out. We'll link that.
And the
it'll be on our
the
website,
back
though.
Is,
we'll link to you.
Okay.
The message on the back is Heart, not just a great Canadian band.
I'd like to talk to you about Heart. It's an appeal about being more open-hearted. I believe that that British people tend to feel more protected the less that people know about them, the less that they reveal about their fragility, about their vulnerability. I'm the opposite of that, and I sort of feel like maybe if I tell everyone every awful thing about me, they'll want to protect me. It doesn't particularly work, but that's what I'm going with. I was at a party a while ago, terrible party, where everyone knew two people, the person they came with and the host. Dreadful. No one knew anything about anyone else. And also, there was nowhere to stand. There was just a lot of very big tables. So you had to just sort of commit to a big table and sit with the people that you were stuck with. And I don't know about you, but I can't stand silence for seconds. I hit upon a question which I recommend if you're ever in a difficult social situation like that. A brilliant question, which is, what's the most embarrassing thing you've ever done? I'm going to ask you now. There's people already shaking their heads. Does anyone want to tell me the most embarrassing thing they've ever done? No, you see, and no one did. No one does. Who's going to sell that? And my theory is people, maybe at number three or number four, maybe they'll tell number three or number four. No one is telling their number one most embarrassing thing. In fact, my favourite thing that happened was one of the guys there said, I mean, everyone goes ashen, honestly, like ashen when you ask them, or red. And he said, my favourite thing was, he said, that remains between me and the person who opened the door. And the only thing he would say about it was that it wasn't sexual, which makes it much more exciting, I think. So we all walked in on, you know. Baffling. He wouldn't tell. One woman, a very meek woman who didn't know anyone, I think she barely knew the hostess. I don't know why she was putting herself through it, but she eventually said that she would tell her second most embarrassing. This is her second most embarrassing. She said that she went to she was in a sauna once, not a, you know, nudie pool sauna, a day spa sort of sauna, and she was quite a buttoned-up British person, very sort of, you know, was keeping her towel on the whole time, and she said that she was starting to hate herself, and thinking, oh, I've got to be more relaxed about this, and everyone else there was just, you know, it's an all-female thing, everyone hanging out, and she eventually, she became quite relaxed and thought, okay, no, she got quite used to being naked and was feeling very sort of proud of herself, but did get quite dehydrated, and so and spoke to the woman who handed out the towels and said, is there any water? And the woman said, yeah, there's free water, it's just through there. She said, oh, thank you. Went down this, sort of, everything's white, out into the corridor, steam starting to disperse. She heads to the end of this corridor, goes into another sort of big white room with a counter. So goes up to the counter, and a woman appears with clothes on. And she says, oh, is there any water? And she said, yes, there's water, sorry, I haven't got any here, I'll go and get some. Leaves. And through another door, people just started filing in. Clothed people just started filing in. And it turns out she was in a gym cafe. just naked, miles from her towel, and waiting for this woman. And she just had to style us out. She just had to say, yeah, you know, because what do you do? You can't do that. And she was just like, I'm naked. This was her second. It's absolutely baffling to me. I think it's really sad that she wouldn't tell us her most embarrassing. I do get annoyed with people being too embarrassed. I'm in comedy and I'm very clumsy. I'm not very embarrassable. I used to work in an office, and I once was approached by another meek woman. In another department, when I was at the drinks machine, and she came up and said, sorry, your skirt's tucked into your knickers. And I was grateful to her. There's part of me just like, oh, all right, but you know, it's going, oh God, thank you, sort of saved by that. And shortly afterwards, my department moved offices for a few years. And after 4 years, we moved back to the office. And I happened to see, on my first day back in the office, I happened to see this woman. It's the only time I've ever met her, was her telling me about my knickers. And I was in the lift with her, and I sort of smiled, and she went scarlet, absolutely scarlet. And I was like, really? Four years later, you're still embarrassed at seeing part of my bum? Really? And it wasn't until I got out of the lift and went into the canteen, I caught sight of myself. And my knickers were stuck. I mean, my skirt was stuck in my knickers. So this woman has gone from thinking I'm a sort of hapless chump to thinking I'm some kind of massive exhibitionist. I enjoy showing different parts of my arse to accountants. I can't tell you. So, but that was at least only one woman really who saw. I mean, I hope she's the only person who saw that. But it's not as bad as the time that I was mugged by a seagull in front of a lot of people. I had we were sort of in this lovely fishing village in Devon, and I know that when you have fish and chips, you know, they've got signs saying be careful of the seagulls, and so I was really being careful, sort of half listening to my boyfriend as we sort of walked along the front, and sort of really watching out for seagulls like that. I was hit, I thought it was a hammer, I honestly thought it was a hammer, the back of my head hit so hard that I dropped my fish and chips, and he and all his fucking little mates came swooping around and were picking up the fish and chips, and I'm trying not to cry because it's, you know, really, I had a scab on the back of my neck for 2 weeks, yeah, it was really bad, and then I sort of led away trying not to cry and then going, realising that my glasses had been knocked off as well. Having to go back and scrabble these chips, put my specs on. Such a pathetic specimen, but it was made so much worse. But the next morning, recovered, I was out with my boyfriend, and we walked past some locals, and he saw one of them nudge his friend and go, "That's her." so what I'm saying is, if I can tell you that and I can go through this, then perhaps you can tell someone, me, hopefully, your most embarrassing story so I can go and tell other groups. I'm going to hand you back to Bob now, who will tell you. He's going to tell you his most embarrassing story.
Yeah. Yes. Thank you, Margaret, very much. Thank you. Margaret Cable-Smith. I will tell you during the interval, which I believe is Café Mila's favourite act of the evening. So an interval will now take place for as long as it takes for the people downstairs to feel wanted. So do your worst and we'll see you in 20 minutes, I would imagine. Okay. Thank you very much. Welcome back. That was the same interval as used in the National Theatre's production of Othello recently. You're such a sophisticated audience, I heard someone downstairs ordering a martinis. Yeah, you can have this. Steve said, "Surely you mean a martini?" And he said, "If I'd wanted to, I'd have asked for them." It's all right, he's working tonight as well. He lent me that one. Welcome back to Pulp Fiction 3, part 2 of Pulp Fiction 3, in which, well, I don't know, because that's the whole point of the evening. Nobody in the front row knows what's going on, as you may have witnessed. And in fact, the theme might even be a surprise to one of our performers this evening as well. That is the beauty of Pulp Fiction. So let us move on. Seeing as we've done everything in the right order, it seems, surely, Jane and Howard, you're going to pick yourselves.
Oh, you have?
I didn't turn the hat at all. Actually, Howard, would you like, or maybe like to introduce yourselves?
Okay.
Yes.
I'm Howard and this is Jane. yes. So, this is something that, an idea that I'm developing with radio for at the moment. So it's radio, so that means we don't have to like do any acty bits. And actually, you don't even have to look at us. Right, you can just imagine.
So everyone turn round.
What we're doing, yeah, turn the chairs round.
It's like The Voice.
Great. But if you could just imagine us doing it really well, that would help. Okay, so if you hear Bob growling from the audience, it's not jealous of me or anything like that. He's actually going to very kindly.
Although I am.
He's going to play some various dogs and stuff like that.
As I said, it's a surprise to most people.
Okay, so this is called Walkers, and it's about two shy, lonely dog walkers called Miriam and Colin, who are able to express themselves via their talking about their dogs. The end.
Thank you both very much for coming. That was fab. And then there were two. I'm going to ask Tony to choose this one.
Sure.
And you've chosen.
Everyone's choosing themselves.
So, Ossian, you can rest easy. You know your place. Now, Tony, would you like to read out your own introduction?
Yes, I might as well.
Ladies and gentlemen, hi. Anthony McMurray.
Well, I'm plugging the Shed Show, because I'm sort of doing this thing on YouTube, and it's not something rude, it's just improvised comedy.
It's so filthy.
Just click on it. You don't have to watch it, you just need to get the Shed Show on YouTube. Heart, I wrote... might be that funny, but my mother went to the doctors recently, and during some examination, she had a chest infection, she was examined, and they said, oh, we can tell by your scan that at some point in your life, you've had a very minor heart attack. And she said, oh, I don't remember that. It seemed a weird thing to say. Anyway, I've made a terrible mistake as well, being here, really, because I thought it was all about superheroes. I thought this whole thing was all about superheroes. Because I've listened to the podcast, the first one, it was all about superheroes. So I thought it was all about superheroes. So I've apologised to some of you in person. I can't do that. No,
some people weren't able to make it to the superheroes one. Well,
it's not at all anything to do with heart.
It's like a DVD extra.
Yeah, and I'm not going to use a chair as well, so it's doubly awful for you.
Talk it up.
I'm just going to wade through this. And, I'll set it up because you're all aware of the Superman origin story, you know. Superman, you know, he came from the planet Krypton, and he sort of came down to a meteorite, and it sort of landed in small town America, and so he grew up there. But this is imagining that he didn't come down in Smallville, America. It came down in a small town just outside Leeds. apologies for the accent as well. It had just gone 4 o'clock, and I was just about to get stuck into the latest offering from Action Comics when I hear Mam call from downstairs. Clark, she said. Could you come down? Your dad and me want a word. So I go down. She looks worried. I can't tell what Dad's thinking because he's glued to the voice, which is when I know something's wrong because he's normally been loyal to the X Factor. But you better sit down, Clark, she said. There's something you should know. I said, you've been writing those letters again, haven't you? To the council about the lollipop man. You know what happened last time? You got bound over. She said, it's not about the lollipop man. It's about you and where you came from. Well, just about to say that I thought 39 was a little bit old to be introduced to the version of these. While I was certainly lagging behind in the practice part of the equation, I think I've got the theory pretty much down pat. But she carries on. Have you ever noticed, she said, that you were not like other boys when you were growing up? I said, in what way? She said, you know in what way. I said, I don't. But I do. She said, don't take this the wrong way, Clark. She said, but you're not normal. I said, thanks very much. She said, I don't mean it like that. I said, well, how do you mean it then? She said, you didn't come to us in the normal way. I said, was it cesarean? She said, no, worse. You came down from the sky in a big meteorite and buried yourself 10 foot deep in some waste ground behind the gasworks. Do you want a rock bun? I said, I beg your pardon. He said, I just made some rock buns. Do you want one? I said, never mind about the rock buns. What about me coming down in a meteorite? She says, it's true. Well, I better start getting used to the idea. I look over at Dad, just pretending to listen to Will I Am, although I know he won't be taking seriously any man who wears blue glasses. So I say, Dad, what have you got to say about all this? But then Mam chimes in again. She says, your dad's not your dad. Your dad's called Jor-El. Well, this knocks me for six. Jor-El? The only person I can think of that might be is the Pakistani news agent down the road. She says, no, it isn't him. Yeah. Your dad comes from far away. I said, Morley. She said, you're further. I said, no. Where your dad come from got destroyed and there's nothing much left. I said, Bradford, because I suffered a lot of damage during the war. Well, actually, she loses me completely and starts babbling on about another planet, so I presume she means London and let her carry on. She said, I'm not your real mam either. Your real mam's called Lara. It's all in here. See for yourself. And she gestures to some green crystals on the mantelpiece. Now, I've always wondered why she had these crystals, because she's never shown any interest in geology, and I know she'd had no truck with crystals as a source of healing, because she sets her store by germaline, and her idea of alternative therapy is taking ibuprofen instead of paracetamol. She said, you can run faster than a speeding bullet, leap tall buildings in a single bound, and to top it off, you can fly. I said, it's news to me. She starts to get het up. She says, how can you know you can't fly? I said, well, I've never tried. What sane person would try and fly? It's the sort of thing you do on drugs, and then apart from sitting too close to the incense burner at church, drugs remain to me a closed book. She says, haven't you ever noticed how strong you are? And looking back, it's true, I've always had a lot of luck with jars. Limbs that remain unyielding to others, more often as not surrendering under my grip. She said, what about throwing a ball? I said, I can't really think the last time I have thrown a ball. I skived off games, and as a child, we never had a dog with skives allergic to the hairs. I said, I'm going back upstairs. I'm in the middle of reading about a new superhero. She said, never mind about reading about superheroes. You are one. Your real name's Kal-El. You come from a planet Krypton. It's about time you use your powers for good rather than spending all day in your bedroom. I said, what's normal? But she doesn't reply. So it starts rooting around for some wool. I said, I better knit you a costume, she says. I didn't say anything. Now, Mam and I have always agreed that red is a very common colour. So when I see the red cape and boots she's fetched up as part of the costume, I don't know where to look. She's knitted the rest, a sort of all-in-one leotard, bright blue, sags around the crotch obscenely. What do you think? She says, holding it up. I don't really know what to say. Mam's never been much of a knitter. The drawer in the sideboard, testament to abandoned projects. The booties that were knitted for Prince William, transferred to Prince Harry, then Prince George, now earmarked for his future brother or sister. Amateurish would be the word to describe Mum's sewing techniques. The cape skew whiff for a start, and I noticed that in her confusion she sewed the underpants on the outside. I didn't say anything. She said, this is what you'll be wearing from now on. Go on, try it on. So we go off to get changed. Ooh, that was quick, she says. Don't you look super? Take those glasses off. Let's do something with your hair. She faffs around with a Carmen roll, and when she's finished, I look in the mirror and note with horror she's giving me a kiss curl. I say, what's this? She says, it's fashion. All the film stars are wearing these. I'm not sure she's right. The only film star I can think of with a kiss curl is Betty Boop, but I don't say anything. Now, look at the paper, she says. Brings out the local free sheet. Points at the headlines. Cat rescued from tree. Man injured in microlite malfunction. Yeah, you could do something with this. You could have helped out. You want to get out more. I said, what's it got to do with me? She said, you could have done something. I said, I've got better things to do, and go up to my room. But she's at the door. You think you've got one over me, Clark Kent, she says. But you haven't. I've got one over you. I know what you're doing in that bedroom with those comics. I said, they're graphic novels. She says, graphic's the word. Dark costumes leave nothing to the imagination. And don't try to kid me, there's nothing going on between Batman and Robin. Rich man spends all his day in a cave with a male acrobat. I wasn't born yesterday. I said, well, I think they're super. She said, they never are super. Super with unrealistically large muscles. Super with firm jaws. Supermen. I don't say anything. When I get back home, she's in the hallway in a hat and coat. I've got something to tell you, Clark, she says. I expect you've been wondering where I've been going every day. She says, have you been solving crimes? I said, no, better than that. I've got a job. She says, job? I said, yeah. She said, what job? I said, you know how I've always wanted a job in a bustling metropolis? She said, no. And I said, I have. And I've gone and got one. I'm going to be a reporter. She said, reporting what? I said, all sorts. And Mr. White thinks I could go very far. She said, who's Mr. White? I said, he's the editor of the Manchester Evening News. He's the one who's given me a job. Have a tablet. She said, Clark, listen. I said, have you had a tablet? She said, I don't want a tablet. I've got some news for you as well. I said, what news? She says, Dad's gone. I said, gone? She said, yes. And I've met a new fella. I'd like you to meet him. And then he comes. This is Mr. Luther, she says. Oh, please call me Lex, he says. He's wearing a pinstripe suit, patent shoes and a trilby. Looks like a common villain. Have I the pleasure of meeting Mr. Clark Kent, he says. Takes off his hat to reveal a head that's as bald as a knee. Well, I've always been able to see through people, and I don't trust them. Your mother's told me about your recent news, Clark, he says. But don't worry, I've promised her that I will make it my personal mission to keep your feet on the ground. Then he starts eyeing up Mam's green crystals. Would these, by any chance, be kryptonite, he says. Ooh, says Mam, do you know about crystals, then? I dabble, he said. I could take these off your hands. I could get them valued, if you like. Ooh, yes, please, says Mam. That'd be smashing, wouldn't it, Clark? I didn't say anything. Must be. There's three of us in the office. A young woman called Lois Lane, who's a bit daffy, but right enough, and a lad by the name of Jimmy Olsen, who's the photographer and a bit daft. I came into the office one morning, and he didn't recognise because I wasn't wearing my glasses, so, but he's kind-hearted. I'd only been working there a few days when I start to notice that Lois is getting a bit of a crush on me. Starts making hints about my double life, us having a special connection. She engineers a special assignment for us both to Paris. Tries it on when we're on the Eiffel Tower. I give her one of my hard stares, but rather than doing anything to dissuade her, it just sets fire to her hat and to put it out in a bucket of sand. But she doesn't take the hint and she moves in. I'm not like other men, I say, but she cuts me off. I know, she said. I understand. Your secret's safe with me. You're a Superman, Clark Kent, she said. And she puts her arm through mine. I don't say anything.
Can you just feel the animosity in the room that you got the theme wrong? Pretty positive that, yes, ignoring the theme can bear fruit as well. So it remains, there was only one. And of course the last is the ultimate, no pressure or anything. Do you want to read out your own introduction? Would you like me to do so?
Oh, I don't know. Well, you know, yes, you go ahead, yes.
Ladies and gentlemen, I welcome to the stage Ossian Barnes, Walker, antiquarian, failed marketer. Yeah. And on the subject of heart, or the heart of England is in our forgotten past. Oh. Muse on that one. Chew on that one. Whilst you listen to Ossian Barnes.
Right. On the 29th of December, 1170, as of course you'll remember, Archbishop Thomas Becket was assassinated at the hands of four knights acting under the orders of King Henry II. He was killed standing at the altar of a side chapel in Canterbury Cathedral by a series of brutal sword blows to his head. He does not resist the attack. Two blows to the crown of his head, he remains standing. A third brings him to his knees. A fourth detaches the top of his skull completely and sends him sprawling to the floor. Blood and brains are everywhere. For the name of Jesus and the protection of the church, I am ready to embrace death, he says. Which is just as well. News of the murder spreads throughout Christendom. Visions and fabulous miracles begin to occur that are quickly attributed to the newly martyred Archbishop. Robert of Cricklade was lame and now can walk. Mad Matilda of Cologne was mad and is now not mad. Jordan Fitz Isoff was dead and is now no longer dead. Islewood of Westerning
had his penis cut off, and it grew back. All these through the proven intercession of Thomas, the holy, blissful martyr. These miracles documented and verified by the monks of Canterbury themselves. Becket is made a saint. Within a few years, hundreds of thousands of pilgrims are flocking to his to Canterbury. The monks build a dazzling shrine in his honour. Such magic and miracles are worked at Becket's shrine that for a time, Canterbury becomes the most important pilgrimage centre in the whole of the Christian world. But the shrine is destroyed in 1538 under the orders of Henry VIII, and the rest, of course, is history. But, and I know what you're thinking here, why should its cures and miracles have ceased then? This was the most powerful thaumaturgic shrine in the whole of the Christian world. It couldn't have just stopped working overnight, could it? It's just not credible. So look, I'll admit to you. In the spring of 2013, I was having some personal problems. My work in the advertising agency was very stressful. Unreasonable sales targets, too much drinking, too many missed deadlines, too much expectation. And within my strong and happy marriage, as I hit my 40s, it turned out I was firing blanks. I was infertile, and it was me. I was the problem. I mean, it wasn't a problem, but I was the problem, and it was not an easy fix, you know. I lost a lot of my hair, huge clumps, parts of my beard, my whole body was this pallid of bleeding eczema. I don't expect you to sympathise, but, my doctor says to me there is no cure for stress. My boss tells me there is no I, there's no I in team, Ossian, and I say to him, no, but there's a massive U in cunt. And so we agree that I should take some time off. My doctor recommends that I visit museums and galleries, and instead I walk around the city of London in endless loops, and every day on Cheapside I pass his plaque. St. Thomas of Becket was born in a house on this site. And I think about him a lot, I read about him. Thomas shines with wondrous miracles. He cleanses those besmirched with the spots of leprosy. He releases those bound by the chains of death. He endows the castrated with genitalia. And it suddenly occurs to me that where modern medicine has failed, I could benefit from one of these miracles. So with a track record like Becket's, my problems are going to be pretty much child play. You know, the hair, the eczema, the other problem. Yes. Becket has not been actively healing visitors to his shrine for 500 years, but it may just be because no one has thought to ask. So I do some research. I think it will be important for best results to recreate the conditions of medieval pilgrimage as closely as possible. I understand these to be: number one, the journey must be sufficiently arduous to earn the respect and intercession of the martyr. Fine, I'll walk it. Number two, you should have some actual contact with a relic associated with a dead saint in order to effect a cure. I believe the Reformation pretty much cleared out the UK of the stock of saintly relics, and it may be a problem. Number three, you must have a letter from your local bishop giving you permission to embark on your pilgrimage. I'll send an email. The Bishop of London is quick to reply. He is delighted that I have decided to make a personal pilgrimage to Canterbury and gives me his blessing, although it is by no means necessary in this day and age to seek his permission. However, as far as he is aware, miracles are no longer being wrought in the precincts of Canterbury Cathedral through the intercession of the sainted Becket. Whilst Thomas is still regarded as an important saint within the church, it's fair to say some Anglicans still have mixed feelings towards him. Instead, the bishop feels he should draw my attention to the teachings and life of St. Mellitus, who brought Christianity from Kent to London in the early first century. Well, no. Screw St. Mellitus. I am going to walk to Canterbury. So, 6 a.m. on a Tuesday morning in early spring, I am standing at the top of the Old Kent Road in London. Tuesday is, of course, as you'll know, of course, is an auspicious day for the followers of Becket. It's the day of his birth, the day of his martyrdom, the day of his translation. Oh, he did love a Tuesday. My wife is surprised by my decision. Her questions are threefold. Why the hell are you doing this? How on earth do you think this is going to help? When are you going back to work? After preaching a final sermon at Southwark Cathedral on Christmas Day 1170, Becket travels to Canterbury on this main road out of London for the last time. He knows he is soon to die. This is his road to Calvary. On foot, it becomes clear the A2 still teems with crazy religious energy. There are at least 20 churches on the 4-mile stretch to Greenwich alone. Church, the light of the world, open brackets, breakfast with Jesus, 5 a.m. to 8 a.m. close brackets, Redeemed Christian Church, dwelling house of God, the Love Lounge, although that may well be a strip club, the eternal Sacred Order of Cherubim and Seraphim, the Thursday Prayerist Church. I mean, the list goes on. As he travels down the Old Kent Road, Becket knows that he is going to die. I only suspect I am going to die. It is 6 a.m. A drunk woman in a dressing gown and carpet slippers is pushing a shopping trolley down the middle of the road, causing trucks and buses to swerve dangerously onto the pavement. I am offered an assortment of prescription and non-prescription drugs by a variety of clearly unqualified individuals. My hat, rucksack and walking poles not sufficient to convince them that I am unlikely to avail myself of their services. So, I'll be honest, it was a long walk to Dartford from central London, 25 miles maybe. But I did it, New Cross, Deptford, Greenwich, Plumstead, Erith, the Abbey in Erith, of course, as you'll know, built as absolution for Becket's murder. Now, truant school children stand on its ruined walls and smoke. The endless plodding, the lunchtime pint, the second lunchtime pint, the third early afternoon pint, and then out on the road again. And beyond the Old Kent Road, nobody so much as looks at me. I am experiencing liminality. I belong to no world, a stranger divested of an old life and not yet in possession of a new. I am at once visible and invisible, in the process of transformation and rebirth. I am also slightly drunk. I resolve to spend the next 5 days in a state of ascetic contemplation, removed from the everyday world on a higher plane, communing with the saints. That night I get pissed in a pub opposite a truck stop with a man named Lawrence, who is eager to tell me why his wife is such a fucking bitch. So 5 days, 5 days more of that. I mean, I could do this quite a lot, but I need to spool forward for the purposes of this train timetable. And 5 days later, after a run-in with the police as I crossed the M25, a close encounter with a Carmelite monk, and a revelation as I urinated on a megalith, I arrive in Canterbury. Now, look, I, I always knew that the shrine had been dissolved in 1538. I'm not an idiot. It's well documented. The anticlimax was inevitable, though. A single candle burns in the centre of the Trinity Chapel where the jewel-encrusted tomb once stood. It was the beating heart of the whole cathedral. It's been ripped out. I ask a man with a badge whether anything of the original shrine remains. The pavement tile, he says. I say to him, nothing else? He looks shiftily around, and this is where it all gets a bit Dan Brown. He says, it appears that when the original shrine was dissolved in 1538, two bishops took a piece of Becket's skull from the reliquary and escaped with it to France. In 1960, in a low-key ceremony, the French monastery where it had been kept returned it to Canterbury, and the Catholic Church here took it into safekeeping. A short walk from the market square along a quiet lane, slightly set back from the road, the door is open. The church is empty, a deathly silence reigns. I find the Martyrs' Chapel. Bizarrely, my heart is thumping loud in my chest. I may yet, it seems, encounter the miraculous. I am standing in the aisle, looking up towards the altar. Not sure what to do exactly. I drop a curtsy and cross myself. I'm not sure that's entirely right, but I notice then, directly in front of the altar that I've come 90 miles on foot to see, is a catafalque, and completely obscuring the relic behind that catafalque and the piece of saintly cranium that is in it is a fucking enormous coffin, belonging, it appears from its size and floral tributes on top of it, to a prodigiously fat man named Carlos. This is not how the adventure should end. I want to see the damn relics. So I can't move the coffin that's in front of the reliquary, obviously. But if I stand on the kneeler in front of the altar, I might get enough height, but it is not enough. So I clamber over the altar rail and stand on the dais on tiptoe, leaning gently on the coffin to see through the undergrowth to the relics beyond, which I have it on good authority are Becket relics. And then, somewhere behind me, in the church, a door opens and I hear footsteps approaching. There is only one thing to do. I sink to my knees in front of the coffin and wait, my face buried in my hands as if deep in prayer. They are coming towards me. This may be difficult to explain. There are five men. They have come to collect the coffin and take it, presumably, to the final resting place. I'm kneeling in front of it, in perfect unison, two on each end. They hoist the coffin on their shoulders and remove it from the bier. The fifth man stands next to me and puts his hand comfortingly across my shoulder. They are clearly waiting for something. The fifth man gently squeezes my shoulder. I raise my head to look at Carlos, about whom I know absolutely nothing, and wonder what I'll do. And then it comes to me. Adios, il padre. I find myself saying that. Well, this is enough for the fifth man, who smartly steps away from me and leads the cortege slowly and respectfully out of the church. So, finally, I am left alone with Becket. Or at least a bit of Becket. Mine is not such an unusual request. Medieval saints were often asked to intervene when it came to securing issue. The medieval pilgrim would aim to get as close to the relics as they possibly could. as the physical touch of a possession or part of a saint was thought to conduct their saintly brand of curative magic. Becket Shrine was built with niches so that hands and heads could be pushed through to fondle or kiss the reliquaries which contained his bones. Indeed, the parts of body in need of a cure would often be rubbed against the tomb in order to achieve an instant effect. For a moment, I consider if in this case it would be appropriate, but decide against it. So I stand up and inspect the reliquary behind the altar. At first, all I can see is my face reflected in the glass. And then I notice the tiny fragment of yellow skull set in a sea of red silk. Untouchable. Unreachable. And then I hear voices in the church and turn to leave.
Thank you very much, and mainly for the thought of members of the audience at some point this week, if someone says to them, there's no I in team, so your thought will flicker through your heads now. So thank you to everyone this evening who came. This is really a great indulgence for me, a self-indulgence, people whose work I love and admire, and I get to bring them here, and I want to continue doing that on a regular basis. In Godalming as often as possible. So can we just have another round of applause for all of our Pulp Fiction heroes? To Jack, to Margaret, to Austin, to Dave, to Howard, and to Tony. Thank you to Steve and Jane and the fantastic people here at Cafe Mila, to Helga and to Natalie and to Tamsin and everyone here in the Godalming Theatre Festival fan club, which I hope you now are, if you want to see more things like this. Fantastic stories. The next story is over to you. Get involved. It's a community, not a business, so you can be part of it. You can volunteer, you can help, you can sponsor, you can partner, you can just donate, you can donate your time, you can donate your knowledge, and you can also bring a friend next time. The next time Godalming Theatre Festival will be having an event, will be a world exclusive. We have a premiere. We are decamping to Bell and the Dragon for some camp. Caroline Sheen, musical theatre fans might know her. She's just been at St James's Theatre in London in a Sondheim musical. Will be premiering in Godalming. She's from Guildford, so she's local, you know, yeah, stick together. We'll be premiering her one-woman show. At Bell and the Dragon. So no ticket, no cover price, just come and have a beautiful meal at Bell and the Dragon. And it is on. I'm building to the crescendo some fantastic food, because I'm going to get the plug-in for Bell and the Dragon for supporting this on the 2nd of April. Okay, so book your tickets now. And then we'll be back at Cafe Mila sometime after that. We haven't worked it out yet. It depends on the schools we get involved with, an education special. Where the whole evening will be given over to local Godalming schools. Hopefully we'll be doing a workshop with them during the day, and then the kids will get to do their stories in the evening. So go to the website, godalmingtheatrefestival.co.uk. Come and speak to Godfrey. Tell him how much you love him. He does accept cheques and credit cards. There's also a donation box at the back. There is also Natalie on hand to take your email addresses if she hasn't done so already, and I'm rushing slightly because obviously, as Ossian rightly said, there is a train to catch. Some of you are local, some of
no,
you...
Yeah.
Oh, you're all right. all that remains is for me to say thank you to our Pulp Dictionaries, but thank you to you for coming. See you next time.